We hope that you all had a good lunch. It sounded like you all were talking with each other and connecting. It's always hard to like bring everyone back after lunch because you know that the connections you're making are also important, but then we're also like trying to stick to the schedule. So thanks everyone for coming back, and we hope you had a good lunch. So the next session that we're going to have is our last panel of the day. And for this panel, we're really focusing on youth mental health, and I know that that's been brought up throughout today and different panels as well. So hopefully you all get to hear more about youth mental health issues among the Asian American and Asian community, more about the issues and also ways to address it from a wide variety of perspectives from our panelists today. And we also, we want this panel to feel like a conversation between you all and also our panelists. So we'll focus on a few questions in the beginning, but we'll also spend a lot of time with audience Q&A. So kind of think about what you all might want to ask our panelists after they introduce themselves, given their expertise and their backgrounds. So yeah, we hope this can be like an open dialogue and a helpful and fruitful conversation for you all.
Hi everybody, my name is Beatrice Chen, and I'm the Executive Director at Immigrant Social Services. ISS is a community-based nonprofit organization out of Manhattan's Chinatown and the Lower East Side. We're actually one of the organizations that was founded in response to the first wave of Chinese families moving into the neighborhood. So this is after the Chinese Exclusion Act. Multiple generations where when you go to Chinatown, it's mostly men. And so with the influx of Chinese families coming in, and most of these families at that time, this is the 70s and 80s, they were working in garment factories, and service industry, and what do they need? Childcare. So ISS really has and continues to provide that core service of after school, daily after school programming and childcare. For working families in the neighborhood. And in addition, we are also a one-time grantee of New York State OASIS, Response to Addiction Support and Services. And so we've been on the prevention side of substance misuse prevention as part of OASIS. For me, I think I'm one of the two or three people who come from a non-clinical background here. Prior to social services, I was pretty much in Chinatown AAPI community, but in the arts and cultural field, working at a Chinese American Museum, where pretty much on a daily basis, I was talking about Chinese American history and Asian American experience. And one of the things that we talked a lot about amongst the staff was actually, what does it mean to be Chinese American and Chinese in America? So I've been thinking a lot for a long time about identity from that perspective. So I'm going to end it there.
Hi everyone, my name is Anna Kuriakos. My formal title is Associate Director for the Center for Asian Health Promotion and Excellence. That's the same center you heard about just before lunch. Dr. Arpana Kalbag is a research scientist at our center. I'm also here, though, in the capacity of a couple other hats that I wear, which are reflected in my training. So I'm just going to review where my training has been. I started off as a high school teacher, so a lot of my formation is in education, and specifically in curriculum instruction. From there, I moved to medical school. I decided to pursue a non-clinical track, so I went into public health, nonprofit specifically. And there, I did a lot of youth leadership development, specifically for the South Asian community in New Jersey. And then from there, I am now at the last piece of my the letters after my name, I guess, are the MTS is a Master's in Theological Studies. My last step was in seminary. And so I have some faith-based training as well in formation, youth leadership development for young adults and adolescents specifically. So I have some school-based work, some health-based work, and some faith-based work, and I feel like all of those actually combine really well to be thinking about young adults flourishing
well-being, mental health. And finally, the last thing I wanted to add as by way of introduction is I'm also a board member for the National Alliance of Mental Illness in New Jersey, the New Jersey chapter. New Jersey specifically has multiple cultural support groups. One is a Chinese American Mental Health Outreach Program, and one is a South Asian Mental Health Awareness New Jersey Program. I don't have a ton of brochures, but I have brochures from each. If you would like to see one of these, feel free to come grab a photo, because I don't have printouts, but just let me know. Just wanted you to know that I have it. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. I will introduce you my host's Chinese name and the English name. My English name is Daniel Chen. I didn't know what does it mean. Later on, I learned of what does it mean being there. So I said, okay, great story. I'm going to definitely be the brave Daniel. But my Chinese name is Qin, Chen Qin. So my American colleagues said, what does that mean? Is that the name Daniel? I said, no. It's not direct translation. It means the legend. Mm-hmm. And my American colleague said, oh my God, that's you. So I hope my American House colleague still agrees. So nice to see all of you today. Now, I know some of you and some of you new. So right now I am the chair of psychiatry and addiction services at both Jamaica Hospital and the Flushing Hospital. In the last 25 years, I worked at both Flushing Hospital and Hamlin Medicine House. So I'm also today representing Hamlin Medicine House, even though it's not on the list. I was the medical director there for many years. I'm still attending there. I'm still seeing patients there at Hamlin Medicine House even last Saturday. I was there. So in Hamlin Medicine House, as the medical director, we strengthened the multicultural services, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, Vietnamese, Cambodian, you name it. Spanish, also their program, mental health, addiction service as well. I used to be the only psychiatrist helping the addiction. Mm-hmm. So, meantime, in the last 25 years, I established and expanded the Asian behavioral health services in Flushing Hospital. So I look at myself, so wait a second, how about the medicine has it? Why can't we have it? So we established similar services in Flushing and also a pleasure working with UPIC, for last 5 years. What a collaboration. We're trying working together through different projects to decrease the stigma, to improve the care access and the care quality. That's what we are here for. Right, so hopefully this is an open dialogue. We can share our experiences about the needs of Asian Americans here. I would like to share my experience talking about fostering a mature, effective communications between the youth and either their parents or their clinicians. Thank you.
Hi everyone, it's great to be here today. I'm Cindy Huang, and I am an associate professor at the University of Oregon, and also, I think, like Daniel, representing Yountain Medicine House by proxy. I am the PI of the project that was discussed earlier, the family checkup, which I am adapting for with Yountain Medicine House for suicide prevention for Asian American youth and families. And so I guess I'll start there. That's still my story. I'm a licensed psychologist, a child psychologist. I actually trained at the University of Oregon, which has, a really long history of parenting behaviors and kind of the birthplace of evidence-based parenting interventions. And so as someone who trained there and I went on to, you know, my research career and academic career, always focused on research on, you know, preventing youth psychopathology, preventing youth mental health through parenting. And my own personal interest has always been around cultural factors and how that influenced parenting and how that then might impact youth mental health. Through all of my various experiences, which also encompasses clinical psychology, community psychology, and, you know, first evidence-based child's parenting interventions, where I noticed a gap, I should say, is they're sort of very siloed, and they're in their own little areas, and everybody does really amazing work, you know, at the community level, with Asian American youth and families. You know, there's amazing evidence-based interventions that are really effective, and yet they haven't been sort of tailored for the communities that are just not engaging with the interventions in any way. And that's true for the family checkup. And so, you know, the family checkup is a project, which I can talk more about later, but just to share it, you know, large evidence-based, very effective at preventing mental health problems, including substance use. But have been adapted and used with a lot of, in research with a lot of other groups and minority families, never Asians, because Asian families would never engage, right? So in the same story, this is whether it was in a clinic setting, you know, community setting, or in the school setting, which the SCU has been adapted for, and yet Asian families don't engage. And so I kind of came in and said, here's an area that we need, and so it's been, you know, over 10 years of a systematic chipping away at the adaptation process from an empirically supported perspective. And, you know, through the work before I went to Oregon, I was faculty here at Teachers College, and that's how I connected with Hamilton Aston House. They were one of my first research partners from the very beginning, and so I was really happy to be able to have this funding from the University Department of Health and Mental Health, and then immediately that of HMH as a place where this would fill the need of a lot of families. And so that's why I'm here, but there's a lot more to the story, but also I talked for long enough. So, looking forward to more.
So the other mic ran out of battery. So we will just, you know, pass the mic along. Okay, so before we move into kind of talking more about the gaps that you all have mentioned in mental health care for ADHD, we wanted to start with just from your perspectives, what have you all seen to be the, like, major mental health issues among Asian youth and families today, especially in New York, and have you seen these issues change over the past few years? I'd be here to hear you all about that first. You'll go to.
Okay, so since I'm from New York, I'll start. So, from the 25 years systemic experience, I can see the challenges for the Asian American youth. Is number one, access. We don't have enough child adolescent psychiatrists. The entire country only has 4,000 child adolescent psychiatrists. So that's number one. Number two, the stigma, right? From the youth themselves and the parents and the entire family, right? So, and the available services around that. We don't have, and like Cindy said, we are all fragmented, right? So, you say, what's the opportunity? You know, this is, well, in Chinese, we say, Beijing is danger. You know, every way is danger, G is opportunity. So there's a danger, there's an issue. But there are opportunities. So the opportunities for us is, what we have been doing is to, one, increase the care access. We say, how? Work with the GCPs. That's the first line. So we have the project, that's why we're collaborating with the legal through this project. So HHS under structural racism project to just for that reason decrease the stigma to increase the care access. So we piloted this project with Kyber. What is Kyber? Kyber is a Chinese physicians IPA in New York. They have 1,400 providers. So they are the primary care doctors up front. So they have patients, they have the patients every day, so they don't have the resources. So we say, we are your resource, right? We will collaborate with you in different ways, right? So first layer of collaborating is you, the private office, screening assess your patients, and they are mild or moderate. You feel comfortable to manage it by yourself. You do it, right? But before that, we will be willing to provide the training. And so say, oh my God, Daniel, I don't feel comfortable. No problem. We can provide one day or 2 day training for you. So your office yourself will be familiar with this, and you do it in every patient. And you say, okay, this one is familiar, I can manage. That's level one. Level two, you do it and you say, I think I can do it, but I have a question. They have my cell phone. So they call me up, Daniel, I have this. What do you think? I say, you do this, right? So they say, all right, no problem. If I have a question, I'll call you back. 5 minutes, phone counsel, problem solved. So the layer, the PCP says, well, you know what, this one is out of my range. Right. It's more complicated. Then he will call my assistant saying, all right, you know what? I was doing this patient to you now. So, okay, we established a user-friendly referral process between the two assistants. We get them in, and I always say this, it's your patient. So if I treat your patient 3 months later, stabilize, that's exactly one. I'll give this patient to you. Okay, then you will continue to follow. Next level. If this patient is, let's say, severely sick, of course we'll tell that one, we will keep the patient, but we will communicate through the electronic medical record. We use an app. So, I can tell him what I'm doing. He can tell me what we're doing. So we will communicate. This is the lab. This is the last development from my side. So we will continue to communicate. Right? And they will follow up on their medical side, and I will follow up from medical side. That's another level. The next level is, oh my God, the patient's here and telling me I want to kill myself. Right? Then they have a room set up already inside their medical office. They call me up, I'm a patient. Okay, I will clean up my schedule within 30 minutes. I will see this patient. I will do a consultation and I will gather the collateral information and I will reach my recommendation to the patient and the doctor, say, okay, you can let the patient go home. I will see the patient for that tomorrow, next week. Or versus I am sending a team to get the patient to the hospital. Whatever. That's the last level of emergency care. Right? Why? He said, why? Because, again, easy access. Let me tell you a true story. This is not a youth, but a adult, right? Just like that. In the medical doctor's office, calling me up, just like that. Otherwise, this PCP is going to call 911, sending this patient to emergency.
What's going to happen? The patient is going to be stuck in the emergency room overnight. Whatever it is, either discharge or admit. It's just the way it is. But because I was able to provide the consultation right away, patient was able to go home. And then me follow up the patient with the patient the next day or whatever. That saves a lot of, really, for the system too. And for the most importantly, for the patient. So, looking at the challenges, issues, we are looking forward for the solutions too. So, I will let the others share their experience.
I was just remembering the title of this particular panel, which is Youth Mental Health Across Elder Generations and Systems. And I always like to remind myself that mental health is not the same as mental illness. Mental health is something that everybody has, right? Just like we all have physical health. And so thinking about mental health across and well before problems present, symptoms present, diagnoses are arrived at, crises are had, it's important to me in my work because where I am located in the continuum of care is well before any system, any medical system, healthcare system, and the overall system. So if I'm thinking of schools, if I'm thinking of places of worship, if I'm thinking of community centers, rec centers, things like that, a lot of the work of health promotion and prevention happens there, right? A lot of the work of mental health happens well before any individual is in front of a provider of any kind. And so when I think of what are some of the challenges, I think easily of the things that we've spoken about today, things like integration stress, generational trauma, stigma, access, absolutely. But I also think of things like, and this is a term that I learned in seminary, a poverty of imagination, meaning sometimes we have these ideas about what our lives are supposed to look like, and then when they don't look like that, for whatever reason, lots of stress happens, right? And this could be from a parental expectation perspective. It could be from the perspective of an individual student. So when I see kids in youth leadership programs or in my church Sunday school, the stories that they're narrating of stress are stories that are discordant from the expectation that either they or their parents have for them, which is what's generating a lot of the difficulty, right? And I know that there's categories of mental illness, serious mental illness, and diagnoses that don't necessarily fall into, like, an exacerbation of stress. However, a lot of where the intergenerational communication breaks down, a lot of where the emotional expression breaks down, is before the more serious issues. And so I generally tend to think of, like, if we can all, as community members, not even as clinicians and providers, for institutional leaders, but just as community members, think like, there are so many ways to be a human in this world, and there are so many ways to be well in this world, for us to narrow down a vision of either success or failure to something that is almost impossible for every child to fill. It would be great if we could actually expand those visions. We could expand our own imaginations of what life could be outside of a more narrowly defined narratives that we might have for ourselves and our children and our students, etc. I don't know if all that makes sense, but that's what the Q&A is for.
I want to add on this. So I took a week with Diana. So I was talking to Domenico, you know, the pilot project we are doing, and the educational materials, the booklets, through the PCP's offices, we don't think about mental health as part of health. If you define health, there are three areas: physically, mentally, socially, / spiritually. Right? So if we think about, you know, imagine much bigger picture, then, and we're looking to into an opportunity in community well-being. So we're not waiting inside of our offices and say, well, you are so sick, now you are here. No, we are going out to YMCAs, churches, you know, colleges, schools, high schools, to reach out and say, hey, let's talk about your health. Let's make sure your well-being is taken care of so you don't have to end up in the medical ED or psychiatric ED.
I love everything that Daniel Long said, and I just, you know, as I'm thinking about the questions, you're like, what are the issues that we're seeing? And so putting on my clinical hat and thinking about the families that we're seeing, I think it's all of those things, and I think it's related to just I'll just talk about what we're seeing clinically, right? So I think as someone who works with families and parents, and yes, the youth is our target client or patient, but a lot of the work is focused on how do we work with parents to, you know, learn parenting strategies to improve their outcomes, right? So this prevention lens, which everything that's been said is in that space of prevention. I think the issue that I'm seeing a lot of, even in the last 10 years, you know, pre and post COVID, I don't like to blame COVID for everything. So I won't say that these are just COVID related, but maybe an exacerbation, you know, certainly, obviously in our project that we're working with youth who are at risk, who may not be so high risk that they are at the emergency department, right? But they're at risk of, you know, with some mental health symptoms and signs. Enough that either their teachers or their parents are recognizing a need. That's what brings them in. One thing that I found really striking in the last like 5 or so years is the increase that we're seeing in a lot of school refusal behaviors. And so again, we're working on this population here in New York City of youth who are at risk, who are experiencing a variety of, you know, depression and maybe any co-existing behavioral issues that come out of that. But one of the major issues we're seeing is the depression playing out with impacts on school and in a way that isn't kind of, you know, stereotypically Asian, right? Like kids are not going to school when they're really having a hard time. And then again, bringing in my parent hat, the parents don't know how to get them to school and the parents don't know how to support them. And so I think in many ways, the issues that, you know, I remember when I started in this field, started talking about Asian families, the conversations were always around, well, Asian parents, you know, only care about their kids' academic health. Or they, you know, they don't recognize mental health. And one thing I will say is over the last 7 years, I've seen a change. I've seen parents are much Asian immigrant parents, right, are much more well-versed in mental health because I think as a society, we're generally more open about these issues. The stigma is still strong. But I wanted to highlight that as a trend that I've noticed, right? There's the disconnect, and I think this is the access, this is the education, this is like the services, and then knowing what's available is that access and what's out in the community. Parents recognize there's an issue, they don't know how and what to do about that issue. And so that's a lot of the families that we're seeing who are screening into our project. And again, we are screening in at-risk youth. They are probably higher risk as we're looking at suicide risk. But we actually see more of that stigma being held by the young person who's experiencing challenges. The parents recognize the challenge and they want to help. They don't know how to help. So they're the ones actually coming in saying, what can I do? And we did an elaborative sort of qualitative process interviewing families before we even adapted anything. We interviewed families who had teens who were actively in services and had suicidal thoughts and behaviors. So these were the parents who had already gone through it and were already engaging with services. And we just wanted to understand their experiences. And so many of them had sought out services and had never been involved in their child's existing services. Right? So their kids were in therapy for 1, 2, 3 years. They never talked to their child's therapist. And the child's therapist never thought to talk to them. And so here's where I came in with my, you know, evidence-based interventions for on parenting, and you always engage your parents in some way. That's what makes the most effective treatment, because for kids, even teens, it needs to be a little more holistic. So much impact can be done outside in schools, in the community, with peers and parents, that can be done in, you know, an hour-a-week session, right? But we weren't seeing that, we weren't hearing that for even the parents who were engaged. And so I just wanted to kind of bring that perspective because I have found that interesting and I think it's kind of a larger conversation. I think I want to shift the frame a little bit in terms of one of the major challenges. I think if you're grew up in the States or educated in the West, we sort of tackle it, or we were conditioned and trained to be a problem first model. And so instead of, and in addition to the issues of stress, intergenerational dynamics, I also want to pose that question of what are the conditions and environment that we can create to help youth thrive. And so from a prevention, so prevention really kind of disrupts the problem first approach in that the problem first approach is very reactive. We like to wait for the problem to show up and then we like to name it and then fix it. And that's how we're conditioned. And I think why prevention is really hard to, kind of promote and get people to pay attention to, I think it's because it really, it's not the norm. And prevention really, if it's successful, you never see that problem. And it's hard for us to be responding to an anticipated problem. And so I think in terms of prevention, it is also very much about the systems, the inequities, and really addressing it from there. So in that sense, it's really how we respond to mental health and mental well-being, as practitioners, and it's also as advocates and legislators. The second one I want to point out, and it has been mentioned, is this model minority myth. It really blocks care because the narrative out there is still, we don't have a problem, and because we don't have a problem, we're doing well and we're successful, there's less resources coming to AAPI communities. The AAPI youth are not seen and they're not asked how they actually are. And then within the AAPI community, there are large groups of AAPI community because it's so diverse, and the model minority myth really flattens that diversity. And so they're not recognized as having that as an at-risk community. So I think both in terms of the problem first and then the model minority myth, in terms of being our needs are unmet and unseen. And so I think that's where I always like to go back to the prevention model and really thinking through how to really implement that as a prevention provider.
Yeah, thank you all for sharing about that question. Kind of going off of these important the relationships between youth and their families, and that being so present in mental health issues and also prevention and also just supporting youth mental health. Our next question was, in your different areas of work, how have you all navigated these intergenerational dynamics with differences in values or communication styles and expectations between generations when you're working with Asian youth and their families?
Okay, I will share a recently affected kid as a story to illustrate this, how important to foster a mature communication. Chinese, 15-year-old Chinese boy immigrated to the United States last year, so not even a year yet, last year, last summer, with his father. The mother came to the States over 10 years, way back, 10, 12 years back. So that means he grew up without his mother in China. He grew up in China with his father. So two of them came to the States, joined the mother last year. And this is so sad that so many immigrant families, they don't have good living conditions. So all three of them live in a small room. And even recently, there was in the news that the fire in Flushing, and then they noticed, oh my God, so many people in that apartment because they separate different areas. So anyway, for three of them living in the same room, and the kid has to sleep in the same bed with the father, it's not a good setting at all. And of course, he had a hard time to settle in school, right? So the school counselor noticed, and the good thing is the school counselor knows me personally, said, yeah, you know, about the change patient. So, but it, from the beginning, the patient was seen by a, somehow by an English speaking MP, so they now work it out, of course. In between, because the father is so traditional Chinese way, and they continue that way, including, what do you call this? We call it, what's the term? You know, in China, the parents get a physical with the kids. Right, so he continued. You know, of course the business is hard, and then everything's going out, right? So, of course the father became, no, I don't want to cooperate with you anymore, the kids is sort of caught in between. So, I literally took over the case, what, for 5 months after. I did not change any medication. And right now, it's not a medication issue. It's everything else. So I had to meet with the patient, the kids, and say, okay, finally this operated. I can talk to them, speaking Mandarin from China. So that immediately we got together much closer, and the trust relationship. And then I got with the father at my age, and I said, we had to have a conversation. We continue to have conversations. That's why it's communication is not only just, you know, back and forth words. It's the methodology, right? So the goal is to improve the relationship and the interactions and the dealings at home. Therefore, the kids can not only survive, but also thrive in school and home, right? So we had family sessions, collateral sessions. So finally, after these months, the parents settled down. The mom sort of caught in between too. So, mom settled down, the father settled down. Now he understood. Said, wow, that's a gem. Thank you so much for letting me know. Now I am learning from you for the first time. Right? There's a difference of living or practicing parenthood in China and over here. And there are challenges here, but you don't use the way you use in China. There are other ways around it to be effective. And I also work with the kids and say, these are your parents, and figure out the way to be useful with them, and also in school with the school counselor. So now, not with suicidal, school doing well, and now even part-time job. You can see the smile on his face. You can see the effect is different. He's much calmer. I didn't take any medication. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I'm like, no, you don't have bipolar disorder. No. It's the circumstances. You just came over here. Look at the chaos at home. And look at the poor boy at school. He said, Jason, you don't even speak in the English world. But he's going to be bullied. That's the tough transition. So now, 10 months later, so at least he said, wow, it's not that bad. So the next year is also crucial for him to continue not only settle down, but also to thrive, right? At home and at school. So that mature communication between him and the parents and his school teachers needs to continue.
That's actually, I mean, that's very similar to a lot of the, you know, ways that, you know, we see and I think, you know, in thinking about, like, suicide risk and mental health when there are symptoms that are presenting themselves. Now, one of the most, like, common, influencers, I guess, factors that impact suicide risk, so the likelihood that somebody would, you know, have suicidal thoughts or behaviors, is family conflict. And so I think that became sort of right for addressing, and it's perfect synergy, right? Parenting intervention, but also like this is a core, these are core issues that matter in this particular, in the families that we're targeting. For every young person in general and every family in general, but then the cultural pieces that kind of weave through the intergenerational communication is different. Some, you know, for the families that we're working with. So here, you know, I'll share different examples from what Daniel just shared, but a lot of the families that we're seeing are in the immigrant families where their generational statuses are different. We have, you know, U.S. born and raised children, with immigrant parents. And I think there, generationally, there are always differences, right, between kids and their parents, my kids and me. And that becomes even bigger when there are immigration statuses involved. And we're talking, it could be anything from like, you know, language differences, like how families communicate. And in fact, something as simple as that is something that we're finding to be really relevant. You know, in a lot of the families that we're working with, youth speak primarily English, even if they are bilingual in their parents' native language, they're not. Their primary language is, or their most native language is English, right? And what does that mean? And then for the parents, it's vice versa. Even the parents are bilingual, but of course they're more native, more fluent in their native language. And then English, you know, or they only speak their native language. And we have, when we're doing our focus groups, we're talking a lot of clinicians and families. You have clinicians who are like, I am the language broker between my young client and their parent, which is awkward, right? Like, and also, how are you keeping that separated in a safe space from a clinical perspective? So that's one thing. But then I think there's this other thing that we often forget about, which is just what, you know, you think about your daily interactions with your parent or your child, and it's language-based. We have a lot of families who can communicate. Communication is not always verbal. So you can communicate very well, even if you don't speak a language that your parent speaks. Right? You speak very well. So it's nonverbal. Wait, can I get through every day just fine? And we have clinicians who tell us, yeah, I don't understand why they need to come in and translate because they came in here like they were communicating just fine. You know, parent would speak, you know, Mandarin, and then the child would speak English back, and somehow they could communicate with each other. And then as soon as the topic gets heavier, right, as soon as you start to have emotional words and emotional expressions of feelings, that's when we're really seeing the communication breakdown. Because you are going to default to your native language, right? The language in which you're most familiar and comfortable is how you use to describe how you feel. Even when we have the words, it's not easy to articulate how we feel, but imagine doing that, you know, in a language that's not your primary language, which is not, literally not having a language. And so we're seeing that as just a major issue for any immigrant family, you know, Asian and others, is that piece of the generational conflict can sometimes just come out of these interactions alone, right? That increases conflict. You don't understand what I'm saying. The parent's frustrated because they're like, you don't understand. You're not hearing the big people. So you're not listening, right? And then it just becomes conflict, which then builds on and has an impact on the young person's mental health. Even when the child may be trying to communicate but not recognizing how they're doing it, they're also young. Learning strategies and skills is something that we work on with them. But then the parent, right, like frustrated because they can't quite get across what they want to get across. And then not understanding really the meaning behind what their child is saying. And that then exacerbates all of these tensions, right? Think about Daniel's example, where the dad wasn't a bad person. It's culturally practicing what he practices, didn't have the context of growing up in the U.S., understanding U.S. schools, what are other people worried about here? And then the child not knowing how to articulate what was happening for them because they're the ones experiencing the distress. And so I think that's, again, like why we work with parents, from, because it is one of the most effective ways of prevention is to work with the family system.
So you think that...
Thank you!
So, considering you use the language broker, we all have had that kind of experience. We sort of like in the middle as the broker on this side of the kids, on this side of the parents, because they cannot communicate to each other. The parents, they're from China, they only speak Mandarin or Cantonese, they work in the restaurant, they have no idea, and their kids speak maybe one sentence or two, and that's it. So we sort of in the middle. It's a challenge.
I'll just share a quick story from my own experience as a bicultural and incredibly angsty teen. I remember a distinct change in my behavior to my parents when I started feeling like I had more words than them to express the things that we were both feeling. And so this communication gap was not just like actually linguistic, but it was even in my vocabulary. Like I was learning, as I remember going to college, and then I come back on break, I went away to college, and when I came back on break, I was like, I've learned so much, how come you guys haven't done the same amount of learning? You know, like, I have developed so much, I've met so many people, I've been exposed to so many things now, and you're still exactly where I left you 3 months ago. But that is the reality, right? Like, this is a different, college is one particular setting where there's exponential growth in all kinds of things, not just academic. And so I remember, feeling like in our families in particular, in South Asian families in particular, the idea that like children know more than their parents is a little bit foreign. Especially when my parents grew up with their parents in the same place in terms of geography. So it was always like their parents knew more about everything because it was the same setting. But now, when my parents have grown up in India, I'm grown up here, there's like a new knowledge that they don't have that I suddenly have, which made the communication even more difficult. So I feel like in that intergenerational conflict communication gap, there was a need to even recognize that that was the case, because otherwise it really felt like me, and I'm sure I didn't do myself any favors with how I projected this, it just felt like me, like one of them, right? Which is what I was probably doing at 16, but not what I meant to do. And then the other thing that I was going to say is one way I like to think about generational conflict is sort of in the same way that we think of, is everyone familiar with the concept of love languages, right? How, like, the ways that we express or receive love may be different from the way somebody else expresses or receives love. And so I think about this specifically in my church. We're going through this transition now where the first generation that came here is now aging, right? And dying, essentially. And the kids are much less interested in church, partly because of a language barrier. Because we have refused to translate everything into English, so they don't even understand what's happening. And so there is a
the ways that the older generation has experienced this and the things that they value in it are different than the things that the young people are valuing in it, and acknowledging what those things are has led to some more open communication. But I think what it actually has led to is space for grief, that things are changing, and that that transition will happen, and it can happen with kindness and gentleness and slowness versus the aggression that I think oftentimes older generations feel from younger ones, in the sense of like, we're taking over now, and we're, everything's feeling, and what you've worked for and all the challenges you faced in coming here and setting up this life for us have been forgotten. So I think just the acknowledgement and naming of those things and of the permission for grief is actually really important in when dealing with intergenerational conflict.
I think the linguistic and cultural and knowledge gap within Asian American immigrant families, where the parents speak one language, have different cultural references, growing up in a different political regime, and then the kids growing up essentially American. You're also, it's also the different power dynamics, right? Because we all believe that our parents should know more than us, are more powerful than us. And one of the most common things we hear from our parents is, and the it's actually the fifth grade level of English. A lot of our parents, we serve a lot of elementary school kids, and I'm really speaking for Chinese, for my parents here. The Chinese parents will come to us and say, by the time the kid hits fifth grade, they no longer understand what their child is saying in English. And what's happening a lot now is the kids are on video games, they're chatting with somebody. And, the parents are in the next room. And it really disempowers the parents because then they feel like, oh my God, I don't know what my kids are talking about. And the kids obviously also don't have that language ability and also probably don't want to share what they're talking about. And so that's a real fear also in the parents. And then I think we also heard from the kids' perspective, and I've felt the same thing, like, oh, my parents don't know this, or don't understand, this is the American way, blah, blah, blah. And so those are kind of, I feel like, very unique. And when we talk to the mainstream, they, like, really just don't get it. And there's, like, no, we're, like, starting at different pages. And so, and a lot, and there's also a lack of AAPI data and studies. So it is really hard to convince, say, a government agency to allocate funding and design a program a certain way to really tailor it to what we know will work. So I think that's, I feel like those are, it's like, I have no answers, but that's something that I just want to throw out there.
Yeah, can I add something? I'm so on board with everything that everyone has said, and I just want to add to that, which is, I think, yes, and all the issues that have just been discussed, I think we're really seeing it in this way, the way that we're working with families and in teens in particular, but this is kids in general, but especially teens, where you get the more angst, you do get the pushback, and kind of like sometimes a refusal to hear that your parents are trying, right? Like, even if you give them a reason, like, your dad doesn't know what this is, that this isn't good, it's like, then suddenly you're against them, right? So you're going to have to, as a clinician, you're going to have to bridge that gap, but also address that in a way that makes sense. I think in a lot of the work in general that we're doing from a parenting perspective, we're also working with youth because we want to help them learn that empathy, right? So I think honestly, it's like through kindness. And I think, when we hear a lot of, intergenerational trauma, for example, and how that can get transferred into that, it's the and, right? And where can it be coming from? You can both acknowledge that maybe some of the things that have been transferred to you or that you've been exposed to as a young person was not ideal and have a significant impact on you, and understand why those behaviors occurred. That isn't the same as excusing it. And I think sometimes it can feel that way. And so I think in a lot of the work that we do, we work with both the parent and the child separately, but
kind of on the same goals, right? That's our approach, because we want them both, right? Just like the work of the parents to help them understand what's going on with their kids, there's also work for the kid to kind of understand what's going on with their parent, and that is actually what we'll get to those moments, especially with the language I am bringing back. because we are, as a teen, the teens do have more language, right? They're able to articulate. And so, yes, our elders do know so much more, and they do have a wealth of information that we don't have. And I think in immigrant families in particular, the teen and the child does have knowledge of other things the parent doesn't have. And so it is a way to empower the child to let them know that you can play a role in a way that might benefit you. You know, really, it's like you frame it, right? Benefit you in the long run. And that also benefits the entire family.
Since we have a very diverse group here, and we have someone who has a clinical background, we have someone who works in the community-based agency, and someone in research, academic, and also in policy. So for me, my question is, like, where have you found, like, some unique and successful access points, like Jewish and Asian American youth are in your field, in your experience?
Can you reframe your question?
Okay. So, where have you found unique and successful access points to access, like, to Asian American youth?
Well, what do you
mean?
Yes.
So, we're talking about access point?
Yes.
Okay. So, like I pointed out from the beginning, the care access point, we need to go beyond. We need to reach out whoever is the patients are. Let's say, in this case, the school, right? So we have a working relationship with the school. So that's the connecting point. And we are, again, just like we are the resources for this kind of group, we are also the resources for this school, right? So actually in Korea, we have three schoolhouse programs. So the three schoolhouse programs have 1,800 high school students. That itself is a good way. Right? So we put a clinical house team there, we have a dentist there, and we have a pediatric developmental specialist there, and we have a mental health team there. On site, inside those schools, that's another access for care. But in our case, we don't have another schoolhouse in Flushing, but we, because of the working relationship, we're able to establish a user-friendly referral process and say, okay, here is the case. You can take the patient and we go from there. Now there are opportunities everywhere, right? That's why we're looking into the community wellness project. So hopefully we'll get the grant and we will be able to do much more. And so the YMCAs and the base organizations in the area, you name it. So talking about the prevention, and the access so the community know that one, we learn there are ways to prevent, so I don't have to be at that point. And two, if I got sick or my family members get sick, we know where we can get the treatment. Right? So that's the way to go. Within the network, we say, would like to provide the behavioral health care wherever the patients are. So that means if the patient is in the women's health center, we will take care of you right there. You don't have to be referred. And if you are the patient from family health center, you are the 15-year-old, you are inside the hospital, so what family health center, you don't have to be referred. you will be taken care of right there. We have a team right there. Mm-hmm. And so for those ones, because we have a lot of ambulatory care centers throughout the Queens and the Brooklyn, that's the East New York. We have the East New York ambulatory care centers. They have a big center. What do? We don't have the team on site. So we, even before the pandemic, we already set up the telehealth. So that 30 minutes is nothing new. So even before pandemic, we already set up with East New York. So it's okay. You need a counselor. No problem. You have a room. We have rooms here. Our CL psychiatrists will clean up their schedule 30 minutes for CL action. So for those ones, way down in Brooklyn, we will provide perhaps. That was even before the pandemic. Of course now, after the pandemic, we are expanding much more. So that is the way to increase the care access. Like I said from the beginning, don't forget about their PCPs. They are the frontline care workers, and train them. Like Anna said, mental health is part of health, right? And like your time for them, they say, then you know, what's the it for us? Because the end of the year, they have a lot of 30% cap in the populations. So it's up to them to keep the patient healthy, right? If the patient is healthy, your office is getting a lot of incentives, right? So you either get a $1 million incentive or you get a $200,000, right? So they're saying, oh, this is the end of the year. You know, the company only checks us the A1Cs. What are you kidding, boss? I say, good question. Don't forget. It's not only about A1C. Because your A1C, your outpatient A1C, you don't know why your A1C is always a laptop. Right? So, I said that we are here not only to work with you for those traditional mental health needs, right? We are here willing to help you for another 30% of patients. Jeez, these patients, they're not listening to me. Their A1C is always high. Their high blood pressure is always high because they have bottles of medication. They're not taking, right? Oh, they're still living the way they live, right? They're still getting weight. They're still doing whatever, right? So I said that we are also your resource to work with this population so they don't have to end up A1C 11 again. Right? They don't have to end up a stroke. And now I say, oh my God, Daniel, this patient had a stroke and everything fast and now you see the patient. No, we are here together. Therefore, you will be the winner, right? The end of the year. And they say, wow, that makes a lot of sense. So they will be willing to work with us.
Thank you. I just want to speak to the PCP part because I feel like that is something that is so critical, especially for Asian families, where we know from research that that's often the first place where kids connect and doesn't show up, and that's often the first place parents are asking questions. And in so many ways, it should be easier to integrate than it is. Maybe in certain states, it's easier. For example, primary care has to ask a depression screener, right? Like as part of a well child visit or an annual visit, they have to. And that could be a way in which, you know, it can trigger an elevated score is triggered, that could very easily just become a referral. And I think that does happen. You do get pushback from PCP sometimes saying, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, I don't want to do that. And so I think it's about us, you know, as someone who's a researcher, developer of programs and implementation science, we go in and we're like, okay, but you don't have to, right? You just have to recognize, you have to know, here are some very specific questions, and then you refer. But the, I think what I want to speak to that part, because I think that's oftentimes where things get broken down, for the access, the engagement in further services breaks down. Unless you have a wonderful program like Daniel's describing, where it's sort of wraparound and it's very comprehensive, which is exactly the kind of thing that we need, but it's hard to find, right, at the community level. And it's hard to really start. And then, imagine Daniel took a lot of work, right, for you.
Well, yes. So that means that if I remember I was in San Diego in the Universal Studio, you know, I got a phone call.
Right.
Where are you? Poor? I'm in San Diego. So that happens. So you have to be available, of course. You have to be available because you don't know which system is going to call you and when.
Right. So you don't know, and then you're willing. And,
I said, oh, yeah, this one is the best. And, you know, so the more you have that kind of experience, get more comfortable with you, they will influence their peers. Right? And then the more peers do it, so I will go with the whole care pipeline members. That's my next step. So I just say, hey, that's great. That's
yeah. So I would love to see, I think that's where the field should go, right? That's how we can really best serve youth and families and people in general, meeting them where they're at. And I think there are still inherently a lot of challenges. Even within our own project at One Behavioral Health Center, it's hard to get people connected to the services that they need because in another way, everybody's really siloed. And so, I think PCPs and primary care is a place where prevention can really happen, and I think part of that is also the money has to be there to support it. I'm thinking about a colleague in California, and this is pediatric primary care, which is a big part of a policy change, where now they can bill, so pediatric 0 to 5, they can bill in California for preventive care, which includes parenting support for people with kids 0 to 5. And even with that, you know, her challenge is that now there's money for it. So there's the buying for the money, but the buying from the clinics and the hospitals and the settings that are providing the primary care, she's having to do a lot of training on how do you bill it, and how do you think about prevention, and think about Beatrice, what you're saying. And people don't think prevention oriented, especially in the medical field. And so how do you even help providers think about all of the work that we're doing as prevention, because it is, right? It's always prevention in our mind. But I do think that there's really great work being done. I'm sure my colleagues here will have more to share with.
Actually, I just want to add to what you just talked about. I mean, 2005, I represented the Hammond Medicine House to participate in a national program. So, three organizations, American Psychiatric Association and the two other national organizations, one is for OBGYN, the other one is for family medicine. Three national organizations came together and said, let's do a project. We call it the THQ9 project. Back in then, over 20 years ago. And so think about family medicine house, what a pioneer, right? So I represented the Hammond Medicine House, that is the project. The purpose, again, is to work with the PCPs and the OBs and say, hey, in your office, let's do this, right? THQ9, it's the fixed vital signs, let's do it. So we did the project, we presented it, we published it, the whole thing. And now it's more, you know, right? 20 years later, almost everybody's doing it. Now, the insurance plans are willing to say, oh, you are the pediatrician, you did this, you can bill for extra fees because you did this. Or, for kind of members, because they are value-based. Now, they're complicated. So they're saying, okay, if we do this, we will be able to keep our patient healthy, and therefore we keep the money. Right? The money is spent. You want to keep it, right? So that makes a lot of sense. So now, also, even though today we're talking about youth, I look towards across the lifespan, and I just received a big book from DOH
because I also represented the Behavioral Health team for the New York State Master Aging Plan. Okay, so now they just published it. Again, PCPs play a big role too on this side, right? And we are the backup for the PCPs too, for the aging population. Same thing, even though, you know, they age different, but it's supposed to be cross diversity.
I did just want to add, just in terms of how a lot of immigrant communities operate, I think more value needs to be placed on peers, because it is very trust-based, and given the discrimination against Asian Americans, there is that sort of distrust towards anything institutional, government, and I think even nonprofits. And so I think this, and there is a movement to really, you know, activate the peers, and it could be community stakeholders, community members, or even just trusted people in your community. For example, your hairdresser, you know, and sort of training them to be that first line, and also community members who are, we call them snowbirds, especially in Chinatown. If you can identify a few snowbirds, like, they're like the influencers, you know. If you need to mobilize somebody, you identify one person, and then they send out a WeChat message, and oh my gosh, they'll show up. You know, so it's like using those very informal structures. And just speaking for Chinatown really operates on that very informal structure that you don't really know about, and doesn't get any press or anything. But that, if you're in Chinatown, you really do feel it and see it. And so for us, it is really always leveraging that. But at the base of it, it is really trust. It's showing up. It's being there. It takes time. And so I think that's really something that I've seen, and would love to continue to leverage and kind of work through and working with PCPs, and all of that, and to get, education awareness. I think that is, we're still kind of at that stage, I think, to build that educational awareness, for a lot of parents and also for youth, about mental health, and also this, like, it's okay to seek help, just working through all of that.
Yeah, I think we will go ahead and wrap up this third session. But thank you so much to all the wonderful people.